Welcome to the Next Trip Podcast with Doug and Drew.
This is an aviation and travel podcast covering current topics and trip reviews with multiple course deviations on our route.
All thoughts and opinions are our own.
Welcome to Boarding Pass 26, everyone. This is Drew, and I am here with Doug. We're two av geeks and aviation professionals creating a safe space for other av geeks and travel enthusiasts to obsess about all things aviation.
Good day, everyone. We hope this episode finds you safe, healthy, and in good spirits. We are 1 week closer to this crisis being over, and we're staying positive and aviation tough. Today, we're joined by a young av geek, a writer and photographer, a YouTuber, an aviation student. His name is Joey Girardi. Joey did a trip across the U.S. on turboprops, which he wrote about for airlinegeeks.com, and that's going to be the main thing that we talk about today. So we're really excited to hear about that. Welcome, Joey.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good. Hey, Joey. So Doug and I are essential employees, which makes me feel more important than I probably am. So we're still working. So we've had busy weeks. What about you? How's your life, your home life at least?
It's going good so far. I'm also an employee. I work at the airport.
So you're essential?
Yeah. Yes, I am essential. So I'm one of those people that's still out there in the workforce.
All right, Joey, let's get to know you a little bit. Tell us about how you got into aviation, what attracts you to propeller planes mainly, and then what you're looking to do in your aviation career.
It's always kind of been transportation. Of course, when I was younger, as a little boy, I was obsessed with trains and Thomas the Tank Engine, all that fun stuff. For a short time in middle school, for some reason, I wanted to be a bus driver. I don't know why. And then, well, yeah,
Airbus.
Really,
I mean, you could be an Airbus driver.
I guess can't be. And then around fifth or sixth grade, it kind of switched over to planes, and it just stuck there.
Yeah, I think that's common. When I was young, I just wanted to drive anything, and I would have taken a bus, anything with wheels. But then first trip to the airport that I can remember, that was it. It was all about airplanes. Yeah. All right, so now prop planes, Joey, they're louder, they're slower, usually cramped. What attracts you to them specifically?
Obviously, there are newer planes coming out every couple of years, and they're all starting to kind of look the same. I mean, obviously there are differences between them, but I kind of miss the days of when there were 20 or 30 different types of airplanes flying around the skies.
Yeah.
And propeller planes just kind of bring me back to that simpler time of when everything was different and all the aircraft and airlines just didn't look the same.
Yeah, you're right. There was a lot of variety back then, even in the jets, because you had the DC-10, the TriStar, the 47. They're all so different. And now everything looks like a 767, you know?
Right.
Well, and I agree with you a little bit, Joey, because I grew up in the upper Midwest where we had to fly on a prop to get to the hub to then get on the jet. And so when I hear those props start up, even now, I kind of go back to that excitement as a kid of like, hey, the trip is about to start because you have to take the prop.
Yeah. And same thing for me, because I'm from the Northeast. I'm from Syracuse, New York. So I grew up in the early 2000s when U.S. Airways and their Dash 8s and the Saabs ruled the skies of the Northeast.
Fun fact about those Dash 8s, U.S. Airways got the Dash 8s from Northwest Airlink after they got rid of them in favor of the Saab in the late 90s. So most of U.S. Airways Dash 8s were Northwest Airlink. So I flew on a lot of those back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, Joey, what attracted me to your story about flying cross-country and props is, you know, I'm so far removed from that, and now it's attracting me again because you really get a face-to-face with aviation, right? Walking on the ramp to the plane, seeing the people load the bags, smelling the jet fuel. And I think we're so far removed because Doug and I are visiting lounges. We're walking through an air-conditioned jetway onto a cabin that has like lie flat seats. And I think I'm looking forward to actually getting closer to aviation with some prop plane flights.
What are you looking to do in your aviation career?
Yeah.
Well, I'm currently going to school as an aviation management student, and I hope to be a regional manager somewhere in the Pacific Northwest or in the state of Alaska.
Regional manager for an airline or like an airport?
Yeah, regional manager for hopefully a larger airline, whether it's Alaska or one of the other small regional airlines up in that part of the country. Maybe that's where I end up heading, but I basically want to end up in that part of the country.
I'm guessing you've been kind of following a lot of the news. I don't know if you guys saw that Raven, who flies some inter-Alaska flights, declared bankruptcy a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I have been watching that closely, and it's interesting because some of the cities with the larger runways, like King Salmon, Dillingham, Cold Bay, Alaska Airlines has said, hey, we're going to step in here and fill in some of these routes for Raven, like Dillingham and King Salmon. Those are seasonal destinations for Alaska, but Cold Bay has never been served by Alaska Airlines before this point. And now that is going to be one of the stops on their Anchorage to Adak Island route. So it's going to be interesting for those residents of that city slash town that have only seen turboprops up to this point, and now you've got a 737 landing in the city three times a week.
So Drew, that's kind of like, that's like the island hopper, but much, much farther north.
Well, yeah. And, you know, with the crisis, you know, one of the good things is we're going to have those tag flights again, you know, that make little stops probably so they can fill these planes up. But no, we're going to talk about prop planes a little bit more in just a bit. But this wasn't in our bullet points, but I had to add this because our friend Doug, who's an essential employee, has a flight he has to go on. And you guys listen to this nonsense. So
his come on now.
So he has this problem, right? So he's supposed to book a preferred carrier. I won't say what that carrier is because we love them all, right? But apparently he had some tech issue booking that carrier. So the only flight he could book was on MD-80s. Could you explain what problem you had?
All right. So, in 30 seconds or less, for any travel I do, we have an OTA, an online travel agency that we have to use for our travel. And every city pair has a contracted carrier, and we're supposed to use that one over all the others unless there are issues. I have to be in Philly on Tuesday for an essential work trip, and every single of the probably 10 options that was presented to me on this OTA for the preferred vendor, I would click book flight and I would get an error, book flight. So it was showing it to me as if seats were open, but I guess they weren't, even though the seat map showed open. Okay. So I scrolled down a little bit farther and I found a flight on Delta that was basically the same price. I mean, it was a couple dollars different. I was like, well, I'll give it a shot. And I clicked on it and it booked. And then I found out that it's an MD-88 from Atlanta to Philly. And then on the return leg, it is another MD-8 from Atlanta to Philly. And this is a trip that had been on the books for a long time. And I just thought that it was going to get canceled. And I showed up to work on Thursday and was told by my boss that it was approved. Book your tickets. You guys are going on Tuesday. And even then, when I went on to the OTA, I was not expecting this. So Drew, you and I have talked about this for the last couple of months, that the MD-80s are going away. The 88 and the 90 are going away. And there was no way that I was going to get a final flight on this. And then literally 3 days ago, I wake up, find out my trip is still on. Oh, by the way, I'm booked on a double 88.
So you guys, Doug is trying to hold back, but he is ecstatic about this trip. So how much do you want to tell us about it, or do you want to just wait till the next episode?
I'll wait till the next episode. I'll probably tweet a little bit about it on the actual trip, but we'll wait until the next episode because we've got some special things that you and I have already talked about that we can do with this.
Yeah, get ready, guys. Joey, have you ever flown the MD-80?
Yes, I have. Like I said, I'm from Syracuse. The Delta's MD-88 and then eventually the 90, that was one of only two mainline flights that used to go into Syracuse in the early 2000s. We only got two daily mainline arrivals from any carrier. We had the middle of the night arrival from Delta and from Atlanta, and then it would go back out to Atlanta, and then US Airways A319 from Charlotte in the evening. Mm-hmm. So I have been on the MD-88 countless times.
We could talk about the MD-80 all day, and we're going to talk about it on the next episode. We'll get back to that. Doug, you got some news?
Something that wasn't kind of on the radar when we started doing the rundown for the show. This happened just the other day. A Pakistan International Airlines, PIA as it's known, A320 that was going from Lahore to Karachi in Pakistan crashed on Friday while attempting to land. And initial reports just said an airplane went down. But in the last couple of days, there have been some really interesting tidbits of information that have come out about this. So there were 91 passengers and 8 crew aboard. And as of recording now, 97 of them unfortunately passed away. What we know at this point, it's all very strange. The airplane touched down 3 times on the runway without its landing gear, and it had pod strikes. So both engines struck the runway in three separate locations, and then the pilot selected to do a go around. And the engine.
Do we know that? Because I know that there were reports of that.
Yeah. So initially, that was the report that came out because someone had a photo of the airplane that showed engine damage on both engines. And
yes,
one of the survivors had said, I think that we touched the runway. And then this morning, I just saw a couple of news outlets reporting that the Civil Aviation Administration in Pakistan went out to the runway and they actually found the skid marks on the runway in three different places where the airplane touched down in three different locations. And then they elected to go around and then the engines flamed out. We won't know until the investigation concludes. A lot of speculating right now is saying that if you look at the components of an engine, if you open up the nacelle, which is what holds the engine in place, the gearbox and the oil filter and all that are at the bottom of the engine. So if you sustain damage to the bottom of the cowling, then there's a very good chance that you could have catastrophic engine failure or damage. So very likely that's what happened, is the pilots thought the gear were down and didn't know what was going on. So they elected to go around, but the engines repeatedly struck the concrete. And then in the climb out and the go around, something catastrophic happened to the engines because they were damaged so badly on these multiple bounces.
There's on their initial approach or in their initial landing trial, there was no report of any emergency or any gear issues. So Mike, I have a lot of questions. It's like, was there any alert in the cockpit from the gear? Did they do their checklist, their landing checklist?
You should never land with the gear up accidentally. And I don't fly the A320. I don't claim to know what the A320 is, but I can tell you it's a lot more advanced than the airplane I fly. And when we select final landing flaps, we get this loud horn in the cockpit saying, hey, dummy, your gear isn't down. Mm-hmm. Part of our checklist, too, is every single person in the cockpit, the two pilots and the flight engineer, have to verify that we see four green lights for our four different, the mains, the center, and the nose gear. So they have a checklist that runs them through doing that. I guarantee that the A320...
Is that checklist right before touchdown?
It's the before landing checklist. So between the final approach fix and touching down on the runway, you have to complete the before landing checklist or whatever they call it in their standard operating procedures for PIA or on the A320. But yeah, there's a visual check saying, hey, I've got the green lights that show that the gear is down. And then there's some sort of oral or audio warning saying, hey, the gear isn't down if you have these flaps selected.
So crazy. So, I mean, more on this on the next episode. We'll follow up with more information, but seems really crazy that you would land without the gear and there's no advanced warning. Or anyway, let's talk about airlines resuming service, which is kind of a good news. It's not as much as we'd like to see yet, but that's a given because most major cities are still in lockdown. May has been a tough month for the airlines with demand still down 92% from 2019. June and July are looking better for now. According to CNBC, Southwest June capacity is planned at 55%, which is actually really good, with load factors of 35 to 45%. Delta is adding 100 flights in June to maintain a 60% load factor to maintain social distancing. Now, Doug is watching these TSA numbers. He recently sent me this spreadsheet, which had like 2 million numbers on it. And his question was like, what do you think about these numbers? And I'm like, I don't even know what this is. So he did have a graph that comes with it. What exactly does that all mean, Doug?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit last week and I can kind of give you updates. As of yesterday's numbers, week over week, we're up roughly 28% over last week. So the number of screenings have increased about 28%. To give you an idea of where we're at too, the high number this week was 348,000 screenings, and that was on the 22nd, and that was an 87.5% drop year over year from last year, which is huge. Wow. Which is that it's on the outside, it seems like, wow, 87% below last year, that's awful. But when we've been 92-93%, unexpectedly this week, it jumped up into the mid-80s. And I'm curious to see what it'll look like next week because it is Memorial Day weekend. And so historically, a lot more travel that weekend, but nothing is open. Right. And so I don't know if this is just a natural growth because people are starting to travel more. I doubt that there's a lot of increase just based on the holiday weekend. Mm-hmm. And I know you asked me last week, it may have been on the podcast or offline, I can't remember, but you said, is it exponential? meaning the growth, yeah. Is it exponential? So I created this graph and I was looking at it. It's not exponential, but it is not linear. It's better than linear. Okay. It's not a straight line growth. It is growing week over week a little bit more. To this point, I can't say it's exponential, but again, at least it's not linear, meaning every week it's getting just a little bit better.
Okay.
None of the airlines were predicting this. In fact, Scott Kirby, yeah, at United, at Bastion, at Delta, they all said they were expecting net negative in bookings, meaning more people cancel flights than book new flights to the end of the year.
Yeah.
We're in May now, and they're already saying that they're seeing positive bookings, both short and long term.
Yeah.
So we'll see if this is a trend that continues.
Yeah, one of the airline executives, I can't remember which airline, they said their profit expectations in the fourth quarter would be 30% less than in 2019. If that correlates to load factor, that would mean a 70% load factor, which would be awesome.
Yeah.
Right? So let's hope for that. But, you know, let's look at the big picture. Hopefully we're out of this and the cases of COVID-19 are going down, because if they're not, and we open up, we may have to close down again if it was the wrong decision. So we'll hope for the best. And I think even when these cities open up, I think a lot of us are still going to maintain some common sense safeguards, right?
When
we
go out and stuff. Wear a mask, wash our hands, and hopefully we don't have to do this again.
Yeah.
Joey, are you seeing any rise in customers or bags or whatever?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said earlier, I work at the airport or within the airport. And this past Thursday, the tram that runs between the terminals here at Denver, it's been empty for months now. And Friday morning, the trams were almost completely packed. I mean, obviously not people shoulder to shoulder, but a dramatic increase in passengers from even Thursday to just Friday. I was shocked when I went into work and saw that increase in numbers. And the departure boards, you know, the boards at the airport that show the arrivals and departures, there was about 8 of them at Denver. Up until Friday, 1, 2, maybe 3 boards were full with flights. Friday morning, I got into work, all 8 departure boards were full with flights.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah. So I've already been seeing a dramatic increase, even just Thursday to Friday, which I didn't expect.
Yeah, I can tell you guys, without revealing specific numbers, our load factors where I work are going up exponentially. I mean, it's really good to see. So now we are seeing a trickle of flights added. It just seems like every month it's more and more. So we're on a good trend. But like I said, hopefully this virus, we have it at least plateauing. So
yeah, hopefully it stays like that. It's good to see. The thing that I look probably most forward to every day, aside from talking aviation stuff with Drew every hour, is when TSA releases their numbers around 6:00 a.m. local time, between 5 and 6 where I am. I'm usually up with a cup of coffee, refreshing the screen, waiting for the numbers to come in.
And 90% of the time, you'll send me something or I'll send you something. It's like, yeah, I was going to send you that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a waste of time because we've both seen it.
All right. Should we move on to our main topic, which is the real reason why Joey is here, and we're really excited to talk about his propeller airplane flying. So before we get into that, let's talk about what we call EAS, which is Essential Air Service. And that's why a lot of these propeller flights exist. So the Airline Deregulation Act, the ADA, which was passed in 1978, allowed carriers to basically control their own destiny. They could decide where they're going to serve, who they're going to fly, what airplanes they're going to fly, where they're going to fly, free market economics, etc. The Essential Air Service program was put into place to guarantee that some of these smaller communities that they were afraid would lose some of that traffic were still served. The U.S. Department of Transportation, the DOT, is the one who mandates who is eligible for EAS service. They're the ones who do the oversight of the EAS program. Now, it's generally accomplished with a subsidized route with anywhere from 30 to 50 seat aircraft or additional aircraft or frequencies as needed, or they can even go down. So some EAS cities only have 9 seats if that's what supports it. And it's usually out of some sort of a hub where people can go from these small outskirt cities, if you will, to the larger hub to then connect to something bigger. The DOT subsidizes the airlines and gives them the money to operate to these places because they otherwise would be operating at a loss. There are currently 60 communities in Alaska and 115 communities in lower 48 that otherwise wouldn't have service if they didn't have EAS.
Yeah, and you know, even during good times, these flights are not always full. It's essential air service, so it provides a bridge. It's generally not a lucrative market, hence the reason for the government subsidy. So there's some news reports. So with traffic down to close to zero, the airlines are asking the DOT for some waiver to fly these routes. So last week, the DOT has decided that they're going to allow carriers to reduce these EAS frequencies due to the pandemic. So in the lower 48, if a carrier operates at least one flight 6 days a week, they will still subsidize any additional flights by 50%. And in Alaska, which Doug mentioned, which has the most EAS routes, airlines will get paid their regular subsidy if they fly at least 50% of their schedule. Now, just yesterday, they gave more details. They are allowing 15 airlines to temporarily stop service to 75 airports. So guys, let's talk about this EAS service and what our thoughts are on that.
Obviously, essential air service airports are very important to not only the economy, but the people that live in these small cities. Now, I know there's been debates for years about this is a waste of money or a waste of taxpayers' money. For most cases, that's not true, as a lot of the cities, like you said, in Alaska, they are so far from anywhere else, and people use these flights to get medical treatment or to get essential items like food.
Yeah, I mean, they provide, like, they do some business traffic to these small cities that need that. I mean, there's some business travelers that need to get to Kalamazoo. I'm just making up a city that probably has EAS. So even if it's just a few travelers, that's that bridge to the rest of the world for them.
These cities, they have to be a certain amount of distance from a medium or large sized hub city. And yeah. I don't know the exact number of emplanements that qualifies a city to be medium, large, or small, but there are several cities in the United States that are at risk of losing their eligibility for essential air service.
Because they're close to a big city.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think the distance an essential air service has to be from a medium or large size hub city, I believe, is at least 150-mile driving distance. And obviously Alaska, the reason there are so many cities is because most of these cities don't have roads, so that automatically makes them eligible. One of such cities that is at risk is Muskegon, Michigan. They are located roughly 190 miles from Detroit Metro, which is large, but they are 49 miles from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Grand Rapids, Michigan is not a medium-sized hub airport. They are still small. And the reason that Muskegon is at risk is because over the past 4 or 5 years, Grand Rapids has rapidly increased their passenger numbers with Allegiant opening their maintenance base there, adding service to, I think, now 9 or 10 airports out of Grand Rapids. Okay. And once Grand Rapids hits that number of emplanements that qualifies them as a medium-sized hub airport, that will automatically make Muskegon ineligible to apply or to have essential air service because they're 49-mile drive from Grand Rapids. At that point, it will be up to the carrier to say, yes, we want to continue this service to this airport, in this case Muskegon, without the federal funding, or no, sorry, we're not getting funding for it, so we're just going to stop flying to your city altogether.
Yeah.
Well, I can speak to that on two levels, because I've lived in one EAS city in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan where it would have been a four-hour drive to get to Green Bay, which would have been the closest, quote-unquote, I'm not going to say major airport, but airport that's big enough to support several airlines and whatnot. Or a two-hour-plus drive to Marquette, which we still would have had to double-hop to Minneapolis or Detroit. And then I also lived in eastern Iowa, where when I first moved there, we had three or four carriers serving. And then after September 11th, it went down to a single carrier. It was just Northwest Airlink. So if you wanted any sort of good price, because it was $400 to $600 round trip out of there, you had to drive to Cedar Rapids or Moline, which was an hour or so away, which most people did because they didn't want to pay. So it was really only the business travelers who would pay the prices out of Dubuque, where I grew up. So if Muskegon loses their service, then people will have to drive to Grand Rapids. And that's what most people in Dubuque ended up doing anyways. Yeah, it's a little bit of a pain, but you go from having only Detroit and Chicago as your flight options to Grand Rapids pretty much every airline flies to all of their major hubs in the Midwest or the East Coast from there.
Right. And to your point, do you want to pay a little bit more to have it be convenient or drive 45 minutes to an hour to have all the options in the world?
Exactly. And save a couple hundred bucks, possibly even a couple hours, because connections are going to be better and more prevalent.
But Joey, how far is Muskegon from Detroit?
Muskegon from Detroit is about 190-mile drive. I don't know the exact
distance. But Grand Rapids is the closest large airport.
Right. And in some cases, for some EAS airports, it's actually cheaper to fly in and out of the EAS airports because they have these subsidy fare cap, which means air carriers are not allowed to charge over a certain amount for flights in and out of that airport. Say you're flying from Grand Rapids to, I don't know, say Los Angeles, it'd be $400 to fly from Grand Rapids to LA with the stop in Chicago versus Muskegon, it might be $200 because they have that subsidy fare cap, which prohibits the carrier from charging more than $200 for seats out of that city.
Okay, so I'll say this about EAS. I'm not a numbers person, but I can tell you from what I've seen, they may lose money. The airlines may not make any money, but all the jobs that it creates. And most of us in aviation, most of us listening, started our careers in tiny airports out in the middle of nowhere. And that's what gets people into aviation. It provides jobs for those communities. And that creates jobs and money and commerce. So that's my two cents. Now, of course, if there's zero passengers one day, one passenger the next day, that's not sustainable.
Another requirement for these EAS cities, once they have them, is they have to maintain a certain number of enplanements. And there's a couple cities in the United States that have actually lost eligibility for EAS service because they did not get enough passengers.
And this was even pre-COVID. I've read these stories about airplanes operating with 2-3 people on them sometimes to some of the hubs.
Some of the EAS cities, like you said, they aren't that far from hubs. For example, you have Franklin/Oil, PA in Pennsylvania. That is one of the cities that lost essential air service eligibility because they were not able to get enough passenger implements. And their city that they serve from there would be Pittsburgh. It's one of those things where, well, are you going to fly this carrier that nobody's ever heard of to Pittsburgh, which it's a big airport, but it's not an airport where you connect at.
No, it's not a hub anymore. Yeah, not for the last 20 years.
And unless you're flying to the hub of another airline, then you'd still have to connect somewhere else. So are you going to fly out of this small city and pay more money? Or are you going to drive to Pittsburgh and be able to now go one stop or nonstop to a lot of your destinations?
Okay, so I got to mention one thing. So Joey just maintained his AVGI credentials when we were doing the preparation for this, because we're asking about EAS. You know, what are the EAS cities? Like, oh yeah, I created a graphic on that. And he showed us on his iPad all the cities. And I think you just have Nebraska and Wyoming to fill in.
Right. Yeah. People don't realize that the contracts don't all renew on the same date. There are roughly 20 or 30 contracts that renew at least once a month. For EAS renewal dates, it's not a certain day every year. They're spread out around the year. Some that are in the middle of the winter, and there's some that are in the middle of the summer. There's at least 10 cities on there that have switched carriers since October or are going to switch carriers in the next 3 or 4 months that I have to fix.
Well, thank you for volunteering to do that for all of us.
You're welcome.
We'll have you talk about your Twitter. We'll have you talk about your Twitter at the end, and then people can go and look once a month and see your updated EAS map.
Yeah, none of his homework's going
to
be done.
I'm sure I have the time to do that now, especially with everything going on. I definitely have the time.
Yeah. Drew and I definitely have the time to do a podcast.
Right.
No, but that's pretty cool. Let's talk about our listeners and let's thank them. So first of all, I want to give a shout out to one of our listeners. His name is Jason Napfel. Takes a lot of good pictures. He's in Phoenix. He's works on the ramp. He's celebrating 14 years working in aviation, and all of that has been on the ramp. So Jason, congratulations. Here's to at least 14 more years of air starts, bag pulls, weight restrictions. And then he also interjected loading bags in 115 degree weather. It's a dry heat, but Jason, 115 degrees is 115 degrees. So,
well, and on the ramp, it's hotter than that too.
Yeah, because the pavement, right?
Yeah, the radiation.
So I've worked on the ramp at two airlines, Jason, and it was one of the hardest jobs I had, but it was one of the most rewarding because there's very few jobs where you work hard, you load that flight, and you push it back on time, and you get that instant gratification. So it's a great job. So thanks for all you do. I know it's a hard job. So when you see that status pending tag, that's probably me non-revving. So please just put it on. Doug, you have one from New Zealand.
Yeah, so Chris at NZ_CEJJAY. We've got a Kiwi listening to us. He said, "Hey guys, greetings from New Zealand. Loving your podcast. Found it on layovers when Doug was on. Listened to every episode since. You guys know your stuff. Loved it, Nick, on episode 25 in Air New Zealand All Blacks 777. This is Zoom background. Can't wait to get flying again. Bring on episode 26. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate all the international listeners that we have. Sorry that the last couple episodes we've been very US-centric. I know that we kind of come and go in waves, so hopefully we can get away from that in the next few episodes once international travel starts picking back up and we can start talking more international. And then, Drew, I think you've got one more, right?
Yeah, this one, this is from our listener, Anil, and I think he splits his time between the U.S. and India. So he wrote, just caught up on the last three episodes after falling behind. Loved the rants. And I think we can thank my friend Matt for that. That was the most ranty episode ever. So I think that was 22 or 23. It is hilarious, you guys. So go back and listen to that. He said, love the rants. Bring on more. Also, please do an episode at some point on the ins and outs of the DC-10. And we're talking about that, like, as far as cargo, doing a cargo flight, Doug.
Yeah, I think we talked about doing that next week until my MD-88 thing came up. So we may have to push that to the right. Apologize about that, Neil.
But we'll get back to that. He said, would absolutely love that. Huge fan of the show. Thanks for everything you do. Anil is also a train spotter. So we talked about that intersection between train spotting and plane spotting. He takes lovely pictures. His Twitter handle is Cheyenne Yan, Shayanyan. So go check it out. Thanks, Anil.
Thanks, everyone. It's awesome. We love getting this feedback. It makes us realize that the time that we put into this is completely worth it. And even if we didn't get the feedback, Drew and I would probably still be doing this every week. But it's getting this feedback that makes us actually really appreciate doing this for you guys. Right, Drew?
Yep, absolutely.
Now to our main event. Drew and I have talked a lot about doing transcon flights on wide bodies and choosing connections versus nonstops, et cetera, and all these different ways that you can get from one side of the country to the other, lounges and airports and all of that. One thing that Drew and I haven't done and we've never talked about is doing a transcon using all turboprops like a Cessna 208, a Pilatus PC-12, a Super King Air 350, Joey.
Before you go on.
All right, yeah.
So Doug and I, our first non-rev flight was Newark to LA on a 787-10 in Polaris.
In Polaris.
Flat seats.
Yeah.
So now we're going to hear about the exact opposite. Yeah.
With that, Joey, the floor is yours. Tell us about what you did. Tell us why. I don't know if you want to say why first and then tell us, or tell us and then say why. But
well, I'll do why first because it kind of segues into how I ended up doing about this. Obviously, people have, like you said, been talking about going more nonstop with the least amount of connections. Like we talked about earlier, turboprops and propeller planes are disappearing from the skies of the United States. American retired theirs a couple years ago. United before that, Delta a while back before that, but there's still a couple airlines that not many people have heard of, not only Alaska and Silver that still operate turboprops, but other small airlines. It's one of those things that I've wanted to do for a while, and with propeller planes disappearing, I figured I'm not going to get a better time to do it, and I'm running out of time to do that. And with this COVID thing, I actually got it right at the tail end of the timeline because three of the routes I flew now no longer operate.
Oh, wow.
And two of which stopped a week after I flew them. So I really kind of slipped in right under the wire there.
Before we go on, I'm really curious about this. And if you don't want to say it, that's fine. How much did you pay for what you're about to talk about?
I talked to the airlines and I told them what I was doing, and it was kind of a cooperation of the three airlines that flew. Thanks again to the airlines Advanced Air, Boutique Air, and Southern Air Express. They helped me out.
This guy's very persuasive, Doug.
That's awesome.
Very persuasive.
I am. I used to sell popcorn with Boy Scouts. I know how to give me money. I went from coast to coast on only propeller planes. It evolved because even when I started planning this, I didn't know about all of these airlines and all the routes they did. It started off with, all right, I'm going to get as close as I can to coast to coast.
So for our listeners, let me just go through your routing and let me know if I get some of these cities wrong, because I haven't heard of a lot of these.
Right.
You went from Palm Beach, Florida to Tampa to Destin, Florida?
Yeah, to Destin Executive.
From Destin to Memphis, from Harrison, Arkansas to Dallas-Fort Worth, and that was your trip on Southern Air. It was a Cessna 208B Grand Caravan. It wasn't pressurized. You went up to 10,000 feet. Then you got on Boutique Air. It was a Pilatus PC-12, and that was from Dallas to Carlsbad, New Mexico?
Correct.
Then to Albuquerque, you flew at 22,900 feet. That was pressurized. And then your last airline was Advanced Air. It was a Super King Air 350. That was from Albuquerque to Silver City, New Mexico to Phoenix to Hawthorne, California at 22,000 feet.
How many days did that take?
The Phoenix to Hawthorne is only twice a week. Destin Executive to Memphis only operates on Thursdays and Sundays. And some of these routes don't operate every other day. So it was a logistical nightmare in the beginning, trying to get all these to line up. But it took 3 days, roughly. And I was just slightly over 16 hours of airtime from coast to coast.
Was this your spring break?
Yes, it was.
Drew, this is a total ab geek.
Yeah, I
left classes early, and my teacher's like, what you doing? I'm like, I told him what I was doing. He's just like, you're insane. Have fun, though. I'm like, all right, you too.
Okay, so just a side story. So when I was old enough to travel on my own, and I was like dying to get out and fly places, United had a fare. It was really cheap. It was like $100 coast to coast. So I'm calling United because we didn't have internet. So I'm trying to get this lady to book me on as many segments as possible from San Francisco to LaGuardia, and I was driving her crazy.
Yeah.
So I was San Francisco to Denver.
People don't get it.
Can you get me there through LA?
No, people don't get it. Drew, before you and I started this podcast, I was coming back from Vegas to Sacramento, and I had ear ops, and I rebooked just on the app, and I went Vegas, LA, LA, San Francisco, Salt Lake, Sacramento, when I could have gone nonstop or just through LA. Why? Because I had the time and I wanted to.
Right. And same thing for my first trip by myself. It was a family trip. We were going from Syracuse to Southern California. And my dad was like, I know you want to travel by yourself. Here's the money that we were going to use for our Southwest flight.
Mm-hmm.
My family went Buffalo, Chicago, Midway to San Diego. And so he gave me the money he was going to use for Southwest. And I went from Syracuse to Chicago to Detroit on American. And then I get this. I went from Detroit to Toronto to Calgary on Air Canada. Stayed overnight in Calgary and then went Calgary, San Diego on WestJet. And those flights, including the hotel, was $10 cheaper than the Southwest flight.
Wow.
So more miles and less cost. Wow, we gotta work with this guy.
Yeah, this guy sounds like
a good non-ref guy.
I was just going to ask what your favorite flight of that stretch was.
Of the cross country?
Yeah.
The Cessna I loved because, it, like you said, it's unpressurized, so we flew below the clouds. I think our lowest flight was at 4,500 feet because there was really high winds and turbulence above. The Pilatus was fun.
That looks like a business jet.
Yeah, it looks like a business jet, and that was the first business-type aircraft I have ever been on.
Mm-hmm.
And Boutique Air's motto is actually fly private for the cost of commercial.
Yeah, it looked very luxurious.
Advanced Air was, again, that was cool because I've never been on a King Air before that point. So the Pilatus and the King Air were new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting to see how these smaller airlines operate.
Just two quick questions. Security checkpoint. Like, how do they do the security for these flights? Is there a little TSA guy with a metal detector, or how does that work?
For those flights, they did not have security checkpoint because carriers that have 9 seats or less can opt out of TSA.
Okay.
Obviously, Cape Air, most of their flights do have TSA because they're a 121 carrier.
And they have more than 9 seats?
No, they're 9 seats, but they are a 121 carrier, so they opt to have security. That way they can connect into the larger airports, which is their whole thing.
Got it. Okay.
Real quick, sidebar on that. Pre-9/11, a lot of the upper Midwest cities you would fly from wouldn't have security screening. And so you would fly from that city to whatever the hub is, and you would have to go through security from the commuter terminal to get into the main terminal. And then even when some of the little cities started adding security, some of the others didn't. So you still would have to go through security. So sometimes you might do security at your origin, and then you would still have to go through security when you get to the hub to even get into the main terminal.
I don't know the exact classification or what part of the FAA they are, but I believe they call themselves public charters. And that's kind of what they go on, like Southern Air Express. Most of their Gulf region airports don't use securities, and they operate out of private hangars. In West Palm, we operate out of Atlantic Aviation. In Memphis, I believe it was Signature Air Support. You know that, the Signature?
Yeah, so it's FBOs, basically. You're going from right. FBO to FBO.
And then, except in these small cities, like Harrison, Silver City, Destin, those are the main terminals because those are the only airlines that fly to those airports. So they operate out of the main terminals, but there's just no security. They go through the federal database of the no-fly list.
Just real quick, Joey, what was your favorite turboprop flight? Was it one of these?
I'd have to go with the King Air.
Okay, to Hawthorne?
Yes, not specifically the airline and the flight, but it was a very comfortable aircraft. Hmm. I mean, it probably helped that flight was almost completely empty, whereas most of my other flights were almost completely full, if not full.
Doug, what about you?
Era Alaska from Anchorage to Valdez in probably the mid-90s on a Dash 8 over the glaciers and the mountains. Beautiful. Couldn't beat that. What about you, Drew?
Oh, yeah. Mine was totally unexpected. So I was connecting in Munich to go to Florence, and my flight was Dash 8. I think it was a Q400. So I wasn't expecting much because it's an express flight for 1.5 hours. So get up there. It's really nice. Service is really good. It was not different from Lufthansa, really. And I just had a heart attack when they brought down a cart with a little breakfast on a regional flight. Who does that? So that was my favorite.
I've been on entire trips where it was a propeller plane. I went from Portland up to Yellowknife, Canada in the Northwest Territories, all Q400s the entire way.
Yeah, if you're going to be on a prop, the Q400 is the one. All right, you guys, this whole trip that Joey's talking about, he has an article on airlinegeeks.com. Very easy to find. Just Google turboprop transcon, right, Joey?
Yes.
Okay, you can also find Joey. Do you want to tell him your, just so I don't mess it up?
Oh, yeah, sure. You can finally find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube as Girardi Aviation Photography. YouTube, I post my trip reports like from this transcon, and then as well as airport tours that I go on once in a while. Unfortunately, right now I'm not, but hopefully once all this is over, I will be going up to Alaska and doing the milk run across the Alaska Panhandle.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Joey, all right. Nice talking to you. Yeah, you've confirmed your AvGate credentials with us today, so you're checked off.
All right, thank you. I'm glad.
We'll talk more.
Thanks for joining us, Joey. You certainly reminded us of the significance of turboprops and small airports, and we have to keep the infrastructure intact. And thanks, everyone, for taking another break with us during these trying times. We hope our podcast brings you some enjoyment as it does us. We'll see you next week. And remember, stay aviation tough.
This has been the Next Trip Podcast.
Find us on Twitter at Next Trip Podcast or officerwayfinder.com/podcast.
Yes.
Sweet. All right. I think we're about to get kicked off. So,
okay.
Joey, great meeting you. Drew, awesome as always. And I'll probably get this done tonight sometime.